Welcome to the Colorado Review Podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, we take a look at new content from the Center for Literary Publishing and invite editors and authors to read and discuss some of the work coming out of the center. My name is Kylan Rice, joined today by Dana Chelman, who has agreed to read for us one of her favorite essays from the fall 2016 issue of Colorado Review. Afterward, we'll hear a little from the author of the essay as well. Dana, thanks for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you with me.
Yeah, no problem. It's a real honor. I've been looking forward to doing this for a long time.
Well, we've got a great essay in front of us, Witness, by Rose Whitmore. Now, what drew you to this essay, or what stands out to you about this essay? Maybe a few things that the audience should know before
yeah.
they listen.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is an exemplary example of place-based writing. Mm. And, you know, she writes a lot about the desert. I've never actually been to California or a desert really outside of like Colorado. I don't know if we technically count as a desert. Mm. But the way that she describes it, and she spends so much time describing it, you know, really brings you into that. And I don't know, I think also kind of the gifts, you can't really see it until you've read it, but the gift that her father gives her on this trip of, you know, appreciating nature comes through in the essay without her having to say like, he gave me this gift, you know?
So I'm curious about this value.
Yeah.
The value of place
yeah.
in an essay. What I mean, you're an essayist.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk for a moment about your sense of the role that place plays or can play.
Yeah. It can do a lot of things. It can help transport a reader, obviously, into where you're at. And so that's helpful if you're trying to get across something that's really serious, like a father dying. You know, she was a teenager or in her late teens when her father died. And she's got such a wonderful line in here. Like, he grounded us when he told her that he loved them. But place is the same thing. It grounds you into a time and can help you kind of work through those sort of higher order thoughts, I guess, or like processes of emotion and stuff.
So. It's beautiful that the father and the place in this story seem to play similar roles.
They do.
The similar grounding roles.
Yeah, they really do. And I mean, she compares his scent to the desert. You know, she's making all these comparisons to her father, her father's body, and the earth itself, and the desert itself. So.
And one thing that I really enjoyed seeing is the way that Whitmore is able to also bring us to the cosmic level at the same time as treating like a local... A local place.
Totally.
So maybe we can all listen for that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that helps with death, when you're thinking about death. Is that a spoiler?
It might be a spoiler.
Oh, no!
No, that's fine.
Sorry. Spoilers.
Well, here's Dana Chelman reading Witness by Rose Whitmore from the fall 2016 issue of Colorado Review.
In 1996, my father, a high school biology teacher and avid hunter, won a lottery for a bighorn sheep tag, and thus the rights to hunt and kill one of the most elusive, solitary, and perfectly camouflaged animals in the world. We couldn't sell the winning ticket, which apparently was as rare as winning an actual lottery ticket, nor could my father pass up the opportunity for an adventure. So for 3 weeks over Christmas break, my family broke camp in a rocky corner of the Southern California desert known as Devil's Playground. Our days in the desert were filled with rifles and scopes and wind. We had high-caliber binoculars, sights that ranged hundreds of yards, and a base camp fit for some level of infantry that could be accessed only by turning off one dirt road onto another and finally onto a hand-cleared one. This small desert driveway led to a stretch of land my father dubbed Area 52. There were no trees or paved roads, no running water or shade. Our hunting range straddled a wide, windswept valley, just south of a large military mining operation and east of Joshua Tree National Park. We were at the end of the line, in a swath of nothing, where old Route 66 tucked itself neatly into the folds of memory, where diners and nostalgia faded into the chalky white landscape, and the ghosts of strangers lived in abandoned towns between modern-day gas stations. Here, stones piled to the sky, and thin desert flowers buckled under the dust of the earth. My father and brother arrived first and set up a parachute shelter, sage green against the red of the mountains. Our tent sat on a small ridge, overlooking a dry creek bed that snaked across the land and served as a trench to explore when solitude was needed. This was camp. This was our winter vacation. This was Christmas that year, heralded by a spindly ocotillo draped with ornaments my mother brought from home. The first morning, we piled into my family's oversized pickup. My father and 10-year-old brother wore desert camo. Nestled neatly in the truck's bed were a host of rifles and scopes and sights and complicated instruments, expectant, ready to be eased into the long, precise vision for which they were created. I sat in the back seat next to my brother. My mother sat in the front. Dad drove. No radio played, no music. Scouting, it seemed, required the utmost concentration. Under my father's fastidious rules of hunting, looking for a bighorn sheep was accomplished by a family buy-in of scanning the repetitive and slow-moving landscape. The whole family had hunting licenses. More eyes meant more opportunity to find one of these elusive animals. Although I was never going to have to fire a shot, this was the first time I was required to participate in the act of hunting. The going was slow. We were in the backcountry, far from any road. From the back seat, I watched the desert scenery slowly shift by. Mountains that piled on mountains, the color of rust, silica-laden, refracting the light. Dust covered everything. The air was dry, stiff with a chilling wind that whipped across the landscape and created sheer veils of sand that eddied at the base of ocotillos and stunted shrubs. There were no houses, no sign of human life, just our truck lurching over the open desert, rocking back and forth like an ocean liner at high sea, pulling itself over stones and cacti and anything else in our way. My stomach churned. I pressed my face against the cool glass of the window and waited for my car sickness to pass. We were looking for the curve of a horn or a cascade of rock down a slope, signaling movement, maybe a rocky enclave or even a territorial spat between two males. Too much to hope for. It seems the bighorn's sole objective in life is to go unseen. Within 15 minutes, I fell into pessimism and slight boredom. There was nothing to see, just rocks and sand and abandoned mines. But complaining was not a part of the agenda. It never was. It did not matter that I was 14 and nauseated. In my childhood, complaining led only to a piercing reminder that when it came to vacation, adventure, or hunting, I was not in any kind of control. This is why I didn't dare close my eyes. This was serious business, and my father could see me in the rear view. If he caught me sleeping, he'd wake me and insist I keep looking. Most of our trips involved some level of serious business. Usually, it was the business of rubbing up against danger to see ourselves reflected back on the surface. I cannot count the number of times I feared for my life on our family vacations. But to admit fear was to admit weakness. This haunts me still, how easily people express fear or doubt, the vanity of it, the freedom. It falls in direct contrast with the refrain from my youth. Participation is not an option. You will like the activity presented, no matter what. Revolts will be quashed. Teenage angst is utterly off the table. Complaining amid perils that any child would fear is not only frowned upon, it will earn you ridicule for years to come. This is how I witnessed the Sierras at age 7, under the load of a backpack, my brother still in diapers, strapped to my mother's back. And how I witnessed the Arctic Ocean at age 10 from a canoe, mosquito-plagued and hungry. These experiences were bestowed upon us under the auspices of love. One day, you'll love this. One day, you won't be afraid. One day, you'll do this yourself. One day. What I know of hunting is mostly imagined. It is largely a synonym for things I never see. Camouflaged duck blinds that can be reached only by wading through waist-deep water in the early morning hours. There, pregnant with hope, men sit in low-lit, warm little nests, waiting. They drink whiskey and hot coffee, eyes focused overhead as a heavy sun rises. Guns loaded, they're ready for dawn, for that ephemeral moment when ducks fill the sky and are lured down into range by painted imposters of their own kind. At home, I knew these approximations. Duck decoys that lived in the garage, piled in netting, painted by hand. Eyes rendered with a careful precision, as lifeless as the real ones that showed up later. Eyes that stared through the glass compartment of our industrial-sized refrigerator as I reached for an after-school snack. Iridescent wings beneath a gallon of milk. I never saw them leave the sky, never saw them grace the fold of the blind, made warm by human bodies and something else, a crackling pulse, primal and glowing. I know of structures, a small cabin held in by the walls of other small cabins, blending into the early morning fog and tulle of Central California. In the fall, everything is golden and brown, a dying color. When not serving as a home base for my father's duck hunts, this cabin is where we'll spend Thanksgiving in a few years, tied together in bunk beds, warm against the chill outside. I know of culture, of autumn cold snaps, and the taut skin of a buck hanging from a pine at high camp in the Marble Mountains of California. I know of campfires and the slow gait of horses, the cold clap of breath in the night air, wet lips on the open mouths of beer bottles, and jokes that caused eruptions of laughter, followed by silences held by the depth of the forest. I know of logistics. Early wake-up calls, sleeping in the back of the truck, rolling in before dawn. Day-long gun safety courses, little brother itching in his seat, asking for hot chocolate, worried he won't pass the test, worried he won't get his license. This was my father's life, a life of camping and divining, of fishing twine and the cold, hidden crevices of high Sierra streams where he knew fish lurked in the shadows. A life of hardened meat in the freezer, stiff after the kill. It was the thrill of the open ocean, chasing salmon, throwing nets across smelt as they ran through the waves. In his life, he recognized that beautiful chasm between what we can see and what we cannot, and chased to close it with his bare hands. By 14, I was an accomplished smelter, graceful with a throw net, unafraid of the cold of the Pacific, and could inhabit a zen-like state watching the waves for runs of small fish in the water. In the ocean, everything is a mad rush, flooding at you, pulling you into its own tidal heave. Bighorn sheep hunting was different. Scouting for a notoriously elusive animal was a tedious affair, buttressed by the fact that I did not particularly care to see one killed, a desire that magnified as the hours in the desert rolled on. The outward gaze of looking for a bighorn was exhausting. It required constant attention. When I allowed myself quick breaks from the landscape and looked around the interior of the car, my eyes always settled on my father's hands, loose on the wheel, each of his thumbnails stained with a dark and permanent bloom of old blood, remnants from an ill-fated nature lesson with a rattlesnake in front of a group of his students on a backpacking trip nearly 20 years ago. The blood under his thumbs made me think of what we see and what we don't. In the desert, the elusive bighorn was there, but not seen. In the car, it was my father's heart medication. I knew it was in the glove box. There were some spare pills in the center console, perhaps a baggie stuffed in the back under the lining of the bed. The medication was a constant presence in our lives, a series of different colored pills congregated in every corner of our house. They were in every drawer, on top of the dresser, and in the small basket above the microwave. There was a set in his desk at school and in the mess of paperwork in his office. Everywhere pills sat idle, an unspoken guarantee against disaster, omnipresent but never seen. These pills followed us, a conversation laid bare between us, a ubiquitous and yet overlooked sign that this was a dangerous, precious life. Once, I asked my father why he liked hunting. "It's a primal thing, an adrenaline rush," he said. He didn't expand, but I imagine it like a sliver of intoxicating power, slipped into your blood, and with it comes some greater understanding or vision concerning our place in the natural order. The narrow scope of our attention is focused, for a moment, on what is before us and the nanoseconds of anticipating what comes next. Perhaps that's what my father meant. To witness the before and after of life is the thrill. But hunting usually involves some level of deception or distortion of perception. We hunt the things we can't see, usually knowing what they can see. It's understanding the space between vision and shadow. These contrasts weigh heavily when it comes to life and death, and hunting is largely a narrative of voyeurism we carefully sculpt. Perched in the reeds, we know where the ducks will land. We know the path of the deer, unsuspecting of an ambush. We wear camouflage and call out to animals in their own strange tongue. We approximate a life and, in that moment, have power over it, power to pick and choose where and when it ends, a power we don't have over our own lives or the ones of those we love. In those long days in the desert, we drove as a break from scouting. We drove 2 hours to Barstow to walk through the brightly lit aisles of a grocery store. Once, to my delight, my mother accidentally bought only non-alcoholic beer, and we had to make the round trip once more for beer that would suffice. On these trips, we could listen to music. We could be leisurely. We could enjoy, not scrutinize, the scenery. We drove through the back entrance to Joshua Tree and marveled at those wild trees, spectacular in their strangeness. We stopped and dug for trilobites, ancient little sea creatures that had been pressed into clay long ago and were now upended on the side of the road, seeing the sun for the first time. There were no rules in the desert, and we were just as free. One afternoon, my father found a strange, wild bush growing in our valley that he inexplicably boiled into a rudimentary tea. He bounced around camp, proffering cups to each of us, buoyed by his discovery. "It gives you a little pep to your step," he said. He loaded bushes in the truck and carted them back to San Francisco, where he went from shop to shop in Chinatown, looking for a buyer. He was met by stern expressions and shut doors. He had ephedra, a substance banned by the FDA. He burned the bushes shortly after, but kept one in his classroom, an otherworldly talisman, the only thing we would bring back from the bighorn hunt. For the years we were together at school, it perched in plain sight, a strange weed above the requisite jars of creatures frozen in formaldehyde, a secret only he and I shared. As a teenager, I was wary of the division of life and death in the hunt. I was not patient with the contrast the desert presented to me. I'd like to say I dreamt of bigger things while we hunted. I'd like to say I dreamt of words, lived myself into a philosophy, inched my way toward being a better, more grounded human. I wish I could say I saw the future of my days stretching out across a fine line of good things, and that I shed my teenage malaise as easily as slipping into a new skin. But all I wanted was escape. Back at camp, after hours of driving through the desert, I curled up in the tent, out of the wind. I lay in that little dome of warmth, listened to music, and waited for dinner. I waited for the moon to illuminate the shadows that fell across the desert floor. I closed my eyes and tried to nap, but behind my lids, all I could see was wash upon wash of glittering desert sand. I saw my father take aim and fire at an animal only one time. We were in a canoe on a winding river in the Arctic, surrounded by harsh, wild, unexplored land. The trees were stunted, their lines of growth held captive by the changing seasons. The presence of unseen animals lingered everywhere. Grizzlies, moose, the great song of the unknown. A duck, startled from a head in the river, flew wildly toward the sun as we turned a bend. My father quickly loaded the rifle, paused to track the bird in his sight, and let loose a shot, missing. The duck went briefly out of vision. We pulled up on a sandy bank around the corner to see if the bird had been wounded, fallen, or if we could startle more to take flight. In the sand, unmistakably fresh grizzly tracks marred the bank. They came from a copse of thin willow on the far end of the shore, meandered down to the waterline where we stood, and from there, in a rush of wild, they galloped back into the brush. The paw prints of the startled grizzly were bigger than my head. Wild scars in the sand. My brother, who loved dinosaurs, pressed his tiny 6-year-old hand into the claw marks with reverence. "He must have heard the gun and been scared off," my dad said. He paused and looked up the river. "He must have scared the duck." We were quiet, each carefully imagining the subtle shift in the power of the unknown. To escape the monotony of camp, I went on long walks along the washed-out creek bed. As the days passed, I slowly found myself giving in to the art of awareness. It was easier to appreciate where I was when I immersed myself in the desert, as opposed to simply scanning it. I felt the stones that piled up against the pale sky. I touched the bent and frayed edges of desert grass and inspected the cold crevices where rowdy wildflowers bloomed in small, surprising bursts. I watched sunsets paint the desert hills purple and rose and smelled the sweet desert air that welled up from the earth at the end of the day. I noticed small brush bent by the winds that roared through our valley. The whole landscape was sculpted and challenged, churned by eternal forces, written and erased and rebuilt by passages of time that dwarfed our short visit. I began to lean against it, time. I leaned into the openness of the landscape, and with it, a gentle understanding of the freedom that the wilderness offered. I began, in that desert, to see the faint shadows of someone I could become, and with that, I looked down to see myself on the precipice of understanding. I began to understand what drew my parents to the wild. That day, that long-awaited day my parents had promised, had finally come. But try as I might, I still could not see the bighorns in their rocky holds, or the murmur that was slowly eroding the comforting beat of my father's heart. On Christmas Day, 1999, 3 years after our bighorn sheep hunt, my father collapsed at the door of the duck hunting cabin, in the land of tools and fog, where men hid in folds with rifles slung, their breath warmed with whiskey and hope, waiting to own that twilight between life and death. We were told he died instantly. No pain. I was not there, though. I did not see it. What I know is just another approximation. We had spent the morning together until he and my brother left to meet my uncle for a few days of duck hunting. There, while unloading the truck, he slumped down against the door of the cabin of our Thanksgivings, after safely driving my little brother 5 hours north with no sign of trouble. A missed stoplight or a minute delay might have kept them on the road. A minute might have cost us my brother's life, too. The silent tick of an invisible clock kept my brother safe, but it did not spare him what he had to witness. I was not there. I did not have to see it. On Christmas Eve, 1996, a bright moon illuminated the desert floor. Beneath the parachute back at camp, we huddled around the warmth of a fire and sat with the emptiness of the night. A cold breeze, clear skies. We were quiet. We seemed to be waiting, but we were living. We opened one present and sat again in the stillness. "Come here," my father said to me and my brother. We walked over. He wrapped his arms around both of us and hugged us into his lap. We were too big, the mix of limbs too awkward, but he was insistent, pulling us closer to his chest even as we struggled to get comfortable. He smelled of the earth, strong and sweet, and of the surrounding desert, of sage and dust and a distinct smell that was all his. He smelled of things both ancient and temporary. We squirmed, he drew us tighter. And with no record, no one but the stars and that old ancient desert as witness, he said, I love you. I love my family. I love you more than anything. With his words and the weight of all their clarity, he was grounding us, placing us in time. His words were the earth, and he was holding us all suspended, connected, while overhead the spiraling of distant galaxies exploded in wild, mesmerizing arcs. We were real. He was real. It was all before us, laid out in a world that did not require foresight or vision or delineation between what we knew to be in the shadows and what we knew to make of them. It was the last time we would be in the wild like this again. It was our last camping trip together, a thing none of us could see. A light breeze lifted the branches of our Christmas ocotillo, making the ornaments dance. Thinking of those sheep, folded tight in sleep and alone in the desert beyond, I leaned my head against my father's chest to feel what he felt. I did not feel the faulty beat of his heart, the channels gasping and the arrhythmatic pounding, but I was happy under the ruffle of our parachute, safe within the definitions of our lives, away from our troubles, alone in the wilderness. I understood and accepted the solitude we sought. The parachute snapped against the wind, and he let us go, to find our way to the tent through the desert, to unknowingly count down our days together. My brother and I pulled ourselves off his lap. We said goodnight, and when we walked away from the fire, we were met by darkness.
That was Dana Chilman reading Witness by Rose Whitmore from the fall-winter 2016 issue of Colorado Review. I also had a chance to catch up with Rose, who generously agreed to take time out of her holiday schedule to talk to me about Witness.
Is this essay a standalone piece, or is it part of a larger project, or part of a larger conception?
It's definitely part of a larger piece. So I'm working on a memoir in essays, and the memoir is about silence and how my father died when I was 17, very unexpectedly on Christmas Day, as you read in the essay. And for years afterwards, you know, his loss was created a void in my life. And there was a lot of silence around that, both internally in terms of the conversations I had with myself about who I was and what I wanted to do and missing him very much. And in my larger life with other people, he was gone. And when you lose someone, it's on your mind all the time, every day, but it's not necessarily on everybody else's mind. And so there, I did rub up against silence in the literal aspect of it, but also in this very much this void. And so my memoir explores the role of silence in my life as a result of grief. And each essay so far has examined silence from a different aspect. So this essay dealt with vision or how we witness the world and blindness as an act of silence in grief. And there are others that explore language and physicality. And so I'm working through how to create a sustained book out of that, but that's kind of how I'm approaching silence and the greater pieces. And this is the very first piece that I wrote with it being a chapter in mind, where it closes, the ending is very open. It's closed in a certain way, but we do descend into that darkness of unknowing in a certain way, and so we're left to find our own path. So
yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm it's curious to me, this search for silence using sort of other senses other than, you know, the aural. I'd be curious to maybe hear you talk about either maybe we could stick with this particular essay and think about what does it mean for vision or the visible to be silent as opposed to unseen. Where's the overlap between the unseen and the silent? I'm just interested in this kind of like synesthetic blurring that's happening between silence and vision, or rather hearing and vision.
Absolutely. I think that there are all kinds of, so the title of the essay is Witness, and there's all kinds of witnessing going on in the essay. We're witnessing a hunt, we're witnessing an evolution of me as a narrator, but we're also zooming in on this line, this invisible line between life and death. And with this comes what is obvious and in front of us, and the things that are in front of us that aren't obvious, like my father's heart medication. Mm-hmm. So I speak to this pill, these baggies of pills that were everywhere in our life. But we never paid that. I never, as a child, paid that much attention to them. And it was this kind of silent conversation I was having with my father, with the possibility of his death this whole time. And as we were in the desert, not seeing these bighorn sheep that we so clearly knew were there, we were being witnessed ourselves. And so there's this circle, this evolution, from the very fine line of approximating life and death to being witnessed ourselves by these animals and the land that we inhabited. We were, if you want to reinterpret being on the land as being witnessed by it, I would love that. That's sort of what I was going for at the end. But I think that going even deeper and thinking about life and death and what we see, you know, we're kind of blind in the moment to our lives as much as we want to think that we're attenuating to everything. I think we only attenuate to 10% of what's going on day to day. Zooming in on approximations of what I knew to be happening and what I know now to have been happening is where I wanted to sort of dance with this essay. And the hunt seemed to be a really good place to begin with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a way in which talking about silence in terms of sight is actually, I guess casting some light onto the phenomenon of silence for me. You know, you were talking earlier in the conversation about the ways in which when one is grieving, that the knowledge of that grief isn't necessarily understood or comprehended or even visible to other people around you, right? But that doesn't mean that it's not there. That doesn't mean that it's not real. That doesn't mean, much like the bighorn sheep, you know, that they're present in the landscape but absent at the same time. And I think what I'm finding, just hearing you talk about the overlap between silence and invisibility, is I'm more able to understand silence as a kind of the outgrowth of an absent presence or a present absence. So I really appreciate that and appreciate your explanation.
Cool. I hope it made sense.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one thing that as I was rereading the essay just before speaking with you this afternoon, and one thing that I noticed is there's almost a kind of Melvillian strand here going on, like the father is a kind of Ahab here, you know, after his white whale, so to speak. And I say that, I bring up that conjunction because it seems like what Ishmael in Moby Dick is doing is witnessing to Ahab's passion or Ahab's desire or Ahab's sort of the driving force of his life, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems
his
neuroses, absolutely. And it seems that seems preserved in an essay like this. Not to say that you had any sort of you weren't trying to speak directly, of course, to Melville here. But I am interested, I guess, in this what it means to witness not just to other people, but to what drives other people. You know, their desires, their passions, their neuroses.
That's really fascinating. You know, it's interesting. Queequeg was written out of the second draft of this. So,
wow.
No, I'm just. I'm actually reading Moby Dick right now. It's funny you bring that up. And I'm in a little book group, and we were all in love with Queequeg and the relationship there. But to go back to what you're talking about with the neuroses or the drive, and kind of to talk about what we were, go back to your first question. I think that there's this, my use of is the word primal. And in this essay, my father's love of hunting, he explained as a primal thing. And it wasn't, I never understood it. And I still, I'm not a hunter. I don't mind people hunting. I didn't really want to kill a bighorn sheep just because it's nice to think of them out there doing their thing and mm-hmm. being regal in the mountains. But I didn't understand this primal impulse until I started playing rugby in college. And I wasn't, this great, fantastic player, but I played for the national team for a while. And whenever I tried to explain what drove me and what I liked about the sport was that it satisfied something very old in the brain, very, very primal, very basic. And, the act of tackling somebody just really was electrifying. And this is the only equation I have to understand what drove my dad to be a hunter, to do these wild things and enjoy duck hunting, which, is not my jam at all. But it lies in an old part of our brain, this act of hunting, perhaps even the act of rugby, of physicality, which has its own language in and of itself. But to sort of circle back on what you're saying, this drive he had was so much like Ahab, enigmatic and mm-hmm. beautiful. And he wasn't tormented, he had both legs. So, but we were always definitely searching for this adventure in our lives and growing up. And I had a really special childhood as a result, which informs my history, which informs my story. And so, I am changed for it. So.
Yeah, no, I've been thinking a lot lately about the ways in which our own lives and also like political lives or community lives are shaped by other people's desires, that somehow history is just desires excess, that we're mm-hmm. it's all just sort of trickling down or, in some cases, much like a waterfall, just sort of gushing down on us, what other people do and how other people behave in the world and how that transfers onto us. And I'm very interested in thinking about that. And so that's why I was so drawn to this essay in the first place. I was also drawn to another line as I was rereading. You write, "What I know of hunting is mostly imagined. It is largely a synonym for things I never see." And I like this idea that somehow knowledge that is imaginary is still valid to a certain extent. And it also seems to me that this essay is a kind of an attempt to account for things that aren't seen and can't help but see other things in the process, right? Like that moment where your father sort of pulls you and your siblings all together in an embrace seems to be a revelation that we arrive at as a result of sort of this other hunt that's going on. And it was interesting for me to see that those two things playing out in the body of the essay, a discussion of hunt while also sort of enacting a kind of hunt at the level of, form, I suppose, as well. Does that strike you as accurate or... I mean, do you think about the essay in these terms, or?
I think my initial writing and drafting and thinking about this essay hinged on two scenes, and the first was seeing my dad's thumbs. He had the rattlesnake bite, permanent blooms of blood beneath his fingernails, and he had these rattlesnake bites on his thumbs in that car, and the last scene where he pulls us onto his lap, and I'll never forget that because it was such a beautiful moment, and we were so small in that moment. And so I was meditating, on what I could see and what I could not see at the time. And so as I dove deeper in drafts, I kind of realized what you were saying that I was doing. It was, I hate to use the word meta, but there was a meta awareness as an author that I had to stick close in the scene work in order for the things that were being seen to appear. Right. Meanwhile, knowing as an author in this sort of, hovering author state on my essay in later drafts that, I could pull away from the present thread when I wanted to examine something farther away. And I had to be aware of that balance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And it's beautifully put. Has this... I mean, I'm not sure when you drafted this essay or like how long the drafting process has taken you, but has writing this essay affected the ways that you approach essays, that kind of breakthrough that you're talking about? Has it affected other essays or the way that you think about the power that the essay has or the capacities that the genre attains to on itself?
Yeah, I think... I wanted to try and keep this very simple because it was even confusing to me at times what I wanted to say about the ability to see and what we've sort of, you and I have sort of talked about. It's a complex, and the best essays, the most beautiful essays I can think of and memoirs, you know, or memoir and essays have a really simple premise. One of my favorite ones is by Meredith Hall and it's called Killing Chickens, and she's killing chickens in the essay. She's killing her brooding hens. But the hens are a world of metaphor and meaning for what's going on in her life. She's going through a divorce and her kids, she's just about to tell her kids. And it's a really beautiful, simple interplay, but it expounds on a world of meaning and metaphor. And so I think in my essays, as a person, unfortunately, I tend to get complicated and overthink things. And by keeping it simple, it helps other people and readers understand what I want to say, but it also comes out when it's simple. So.
Well, and I think that comes out perfectly well and beautifully so in your essay Witness. Rose, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found at iTunes and at the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.